Yeah, we do a lot of that, certainly, in our profession. So I think it's an important quality.
Yeah, but you got to have the quants to look at the numbers, right?
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Course. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Irreplaceable Truths. I'm Dr. G. I'm with Nathan and Daniel today. Here, we're going to talk about some real veterinary stories. We're not going to sugarcoat it. We're just going to basically tell people the truth and how things are going. So why don't we go ahead and go around the table and introduce ourselves?
All right, I guess I'll start. My name is Nathan, Dr. Brown in the hospital. I guess I'll start just kind of briefly. I grew up in L.A. and went to Campbell Hall High School and then went to Trinity University, which is in San Antonio, for undergrad. Worked in a HIV research lab for a couple of years, did ski patrol in Mammoth, got a master's of public health, then went to vet school at UC Davis when I was 28 and graduated in 2019. And then I was in the Air Force for 3 years. And then I moved back to Southern California about a year and a half ago, and I've been here since, practicing both emergency and general practice medicine.
My name is Daniel, Dr. Sintov. I grew up in Southern California. I went to UCLA for undergrad. I got my degree in economics and accounting, worked in the natural pharmaceutical industry for a few years, and then decided to become a vet, went to vet school at UC Davis. I did a rotating internship in internal medicine, surgery, and critical care for a year after vet school, and then stayed on at the same hospital as a staff ER and critical care doctor.
Okay, let's do an icebreaker really quick. If you could describe your veterinary career so far in 3 words, what would it be?
3 words, that's pretty difficult. That's a difficult question.
Try to keep it PG-13.
Yeah, 3 words is maybe unexpected is one of them. Fantastic in another sense, and personally like growth, or if there's a way of describing that in one word, I don't know what that is, but an opportunity for like personal growth and development.
That word came into mind as well, growth, but I'll say 3 words, one phrase, ups and downs, sometimes both. Nice. At the same time.
Correct.
I like that.
Emotionally, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over the place. Yeah. You can go from a euthanasia to a puppy exam to a euthanasia to a puppy exam. I did that one day. It was the biggest roller coaster I'd ever been on in my life, because you have the whole family crying on this side, and then you have the whole family celebrating in the next room. You got to be prepared for that. I don't really think veterinary school prepares you for that. They talk about it. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting scenario. I don't think I've had like that type of a day. I think the most euthanasias that I've done in the day was like 11. And that was emotionally draining for sure. I don't think you really realize how you don't realize that it does take a toll on you until, you know, you take a little bit of a break and you realize, wow, that day, that particular day was quite exhausting, and it certainly had to do with having to go through that. Although it is a service, and you know, the clients are someone has to do that, right? Someone has to do that, and at the end of the day, you know, it does provide an opportunity for the clients to say goodbye in a controlled way where, you know, it's less traumatic, and they can, you know, all be there as a family, and so there's value in it for sure.
Did vet school prepare you for it?
Did vet school prepare me for that? No, of course not. But vet school can't prepare you for everything. You know, it comes with practice. That's the whole idea. I mean, vet school is nothing like practice.
It isn't. I think vet school does nothing for the soft skills.
Yeah, I mean, UC Davis actually does a pretty good job. We have like a professional development class led by Dr. Jim Clark, who is a mentor of mine, and you know, so we do have some you know, mock client interactions with the run-on client or the difficult client, and you know, we did have some how to negotiate a salary type of, scenarios or mock interviews. So UC Davis, I think, probably, you know, more so than other schools. I don't know if other schools are now doing that, but UC Davis, I think, at least has some component that is helping with, like, the at least the practical conversations that you have to have with clients, which I think is great.
Yeah, I think it depends on the individual as well, because, like, for me at least, I had several years of experience in different veterinary hospitals, from like a community hospital in South Central to a nice specialty hospital in Redondo Beach. So I got to see a lot of client interactions and see what the doctors went through. And I feel like I got more experience from that than from vet school itself. But, you know, there's also classmates that had literally never worked in a clinic before vet school, which was a little bit mind-boggling. But I, at the same time, I don't really know how they would prepare you for that adequately anyways. That's just, I think, years of dealing with people. And, like, in our profession, that's, like, often, or at least in my field, which is emergency and critical care, like, it's most often an emotionally charged situation for the clients. And so a lot of conversations can go different ways depending on how you take things from the owners and how you present information. And some of that, I think, is just with time. You have to kind of tailor how you talk to people and see what works and what doesn't.
So it'd be interesting. Did you, how much veterinary experience did you have before you went to vet school?
I mean, I was definitely, like, Danny for sure had more experience, like, in the clinic. My experience prior to vet school was working at a small GP hospital in, like, West LA, like, close to my mom's house. And I just volunteered there for the most part. Yeah.
So between the two of you, what was the biggest misconception you had about practice coming out?
I didn't realize that, like, you know, and they talk about this in vet school and, you know, compassion fatigue and burnout and that kind of stuff. I didn't, in vet school, you know, they would talk about it. And I was like, what is this? Like, I don't really buy into this. And cause I just didn't expect that I would ever be someone to, like, be victim to that. And I don't consider myself to be a victim at all under any circumstances. Right. And I never will, but you do have to go through, and that's why I said growth. And, you know, the opening statement is, like, you know, it's not just, like, positive vibes all the time with every client, with every patient. There's difficult circumstances, difficult conversations that you have to have, difficult clients sometime. And, you know, stuff that happens with patients that you certainly didn't expect it to happen, but, you know, it did, and it falls on your lap and you got to deal with it. That kind of stuff can make the profession stressful. You know, sometimes can be that one patient or that one client that out of however many we have seen, thousands and thousands that we think about for the whole day or the whole week or the whole month, you know, but that just comes with the territory, and I think it makes us, you know, smarter, wiser, you know, better people, more compassionate, you know, so it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. I think, you have to go through some of those, and, like, where I'm at, I feel like I'm good at sniffing out when something like that is going to happen and trying to avoid that client or that situation. Like, you know, if it's a difficult client, then they are welcome to go get a second opinion somewhere else, and, like, not having a blow up that affects the rest of your day or week or your days off. From dealing with someone that upsets you that bad, which sucks for their pet, but, like, it's a private industry, so we're not like obligated to deal with the people.
Yeah, and I think that like we have to as veterinarians you know, find balance in our lives, protect ourselves, you know, and that's okay too. You know, yeah. Like it's important. Like if we want longevity in the career field, which you mentioned an interesting statistics, you know, before we started that 38% of vets leave the career field at, you know, within 5 to 10 years, I think is what you said, which is, that's a very high number and it sucks for the profession. You know, it sucks for the patients that would have gotten care, and it sucks for the other doctors that, you know, have to, you know, maybe saddle that burden, I guess. But it doesn't surprise me all that much. But that's why I think it's very, very important to have your boundaries and have your support system and, you know, have the other things in your life that kind of help to balance out some of the stress that we encounter on a day-to-day basis.
Other than just alcohol and, natural products.
I would say so, yeah. I'm not too much of an alcohol consumer, but, I mean, occasionally I'll, like, whatever, take an edible or something on weekends and have a good time.
Exactly.
So that helps.
Well, yeah. I mean, the recovery is very important from your, especially from a day, right?
Yeah.
And so what do you guys do? What are your, some of your techniques?
So, I mean, my typical work week, so I'll work either 3 days in a row or 4 days in a row. And like the day I'm working, I work and sleep. My shifts are generally like 12 hours in the ER. Last year I was, or like my first 5 years, I was working 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. swing shifts receiving. Now I work day shift, so either receiving 7:30 a.m. to like 7 p.m. or new thing, working as hospitalist from like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., which I actually kind of enjoy. But anyways, when
so
I...
So the hospitalist doesn't see clients? You just talk to them on the phone?
We don't see new cases,
gotcha.
But yeah, mostly update hospitalized patients, owners via phone, or if they're coming to visit in person, then in person. But that's it's a whole different set of challenges, because a lot of patients that are hospitalized have like diagnostics that haven't been done yet, like a CT scan or whatever, that you're going to have to use that information to interpret what's going on with them, make additional recommendations, and, you know, it's a little bit more of like putting the rest of the puzzle together rather than receiving, where you're just trying to like stabilize and get them to the next step, and keep them alive in the meantime.
That sounds like an option for some of the people that really have trouble in the room.
Yeah, I would think so. And like most people don't like doing hospitalist duty, and I don't know why, and I always dreaded doing it. I never had to do it as an intern, so I just like hadn't done it. And it's really easy to like hospitalize patients and then not have to worry about what happens thereafter in the hospital, because it's not really your problem anymore. You're just seeing the next patient. But as hospitalist, you're talking a lot about potential outcomes, like, I don't know, a lot of like algorithmic stuff based on what this diagnostic's going to show. Like, oh, if it shows this, then this is our next step. If it shows this, then this is our next step. And then getting that information and talking the owner through it and how it affects their pet's prognosis, and sometimes putting pets to sleep that have been in the hospital for a few days because they're just not getting better, or responding to treatment, et cetera. And seeing cases that do better than you expect in the hospital and are discharged. And that's one thing that a receiving doctor doesn't see a lot, is like the patient making it to discharge and having to come up with a follow-up plan and that kind of stuff. So at least in the ER field, there's a lot of different I don't know, one position doesn't do everything that an ER patient needs during their hospital stay.
Yeah, that's changed a lot since
yeah,
you know,
for
I,
sure.
ca- I came out.
For sure.
Have you guys had that one moment where you're like, this is not the profession for me?
No, I don't think I've ever felt that like veterinary medicine wasn't the profession for me. No, I've never felt that way, thankfully. You know, I love the profession. I really do. I love being a veterinarian. I think it's an incredible profession for so many reasons. And a lot of people that I talk with, you know, potential vet students who are thinking about going to vet school, and a lot of them, sadly, have, I think, heard from a lot of vets, oh, don't do it, don't go into it, it's not
worth it. I was told that by several vets before I started.
And I wouldn't give that recommendation to any young potential veterinarian.
Yeah, like, neither would I.
I would say, like, you know, like, you should for sure do it. I think it's amazing. But let's talk about it.
Is this profession
for
everyone?
Is it right for you or not? Yeah. If it's right for you, then you should do it. But right. Yeah, just because you want to do something doesn't mean that it's right for you. And I think that that is another issue in the world and in medicine also, is that there's people in school that, like, we experienced it in vet school, like the school bends over backwards to keep their graduation rate up. And in some instances, like, that med may not be for, or being a veterinarian may not be for everybody. And just because you want to be a vet doesn't necessarily mean you should be a vet if there's things that you don't like about it.
Well, you don't have to go into clinical.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
And there's
plenty of other positions.
Yeah. You could be a pathologist. You can work in industry. You know, there's public health. There's a lot of different jobs. I think vet school trains you to be clinician. You know, that's what 95% of the time is spent doing, which is obviously important, but I don't know.
If you guys could time travel and go back to like the first year of vet school, what would you tell yourself?
Okay. That's a good question. That's a really good question. You know, I don't know if I would tell myself anything different, to be honest with you, because for me it's like the journey has been fun, you know, and like all the ups and downs have been fun, and I, you know, some of them have been very, very challenging and difficult, but I'm glad I did it in the way that I did. And I don't have any regrets, you know, I don't want to live with any regrets, you know? So I was very like, you know, positive and, gung ho about being a veterinarian. And I certainly wouldn't want to make myself jaded, you know, before going into practice, you know.
Jaded how?
Jaded, like,
you know. Client interactions aren't the fun part of it?
I don't want to be negative about the profession.
I'm not either, but you know? I love this. It's a passion of mine. It's my life.
Yeah.
But I'm really worried that a lot of these early career vets, young professionals, veterinary students, some of them have blinders on and they're about, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel might be a freight train.
Gotcha. Yeah, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. How do you prepare, you know, students for what they're going to face, I guess? You know, that's probably a good question. And I think they all really should sit down and have a long conversation like we're having today about like what to expect and what challenges that they're probably going to face at some point and how they want to structure their time in their life and whether they want to work part-time or full-time, and if they want to do emergency or GP, because those are very different beasts, and if they want to specialize or not, and what that entails, and it would probably be good for them to talk to a couple specialists in a few different fields, you know? There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I think younger people definitely need to be in the hospitals, for sure, in order to know more of what to expect when they graduate. Like, I think there should definitely, like, every vet school should have a minimum number of hours that an applying student should have had to have fulfilled in clinics. I don't know how, unless...
Do you think 100 hours is enough?
Cause no.
Most hospitals, it's 100 hours.
No.
I mean, that's crazy.
No, like 1,000?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
like, you should have, like, I mean, like, I had to work to like pay my rent. So I worked overnights at the specialty hospital, for, you know, right. my last like 9 months before vet school.
There's a discussion on VIN that I found that they're saying that we're requiring too much of these students before they apply.
I guess it depends on what regard your
clinical hours.
Like, clinical hours, definitely not, and it probably depends on the place, but I would think not.
I think it depends on the school. Like, UC Davis was very, like, they were really not prioritizing prior clinical experience.
No, they were more about, like, the person overall.
Sort
like,
of
they
a,
wanted, like, interesting people and
yeah.
smart, intelligent, interesting
yeah,
people.
IQ. Yeah, they want IQ, right?
Yeah, we had, yeah. like, just some, like... Someone that, like, rode their bike, like, across the country
to vet school. Yeah, like, someone that was a baker for 10 years before becoming a vet. I think we had a lot of, like, people pursuing vet med as a second career in our class. Mm-hmm. And that surprised me a lot. I thought that me and, like, David were going to be the, like, oldest people. And then we met, like, Nathan and several other people that were kind of... Yeah, and similar.
Yeah, most of the guys in our class were older, around our age. There were a few.
How many men were in your class?
Like 25 or something.
Yeah, it was
25 out of
145 to start. I think we graduated like 138 or something.
Oh, really? You only lost 7?
Yeah.
Wow. We had 80 in my vet school class. 73 were women. We ended up with 54.
Oh, wow.
Interesting. So I didn't realize that. I know you're kind of a different generation than Danny and I.
I'm a 2000 grad.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not that far.
Okay. Well, no, it's 20 years. You know.
Yeah, but it wasn't. I mean, it was like the 50s when it was the opposite. And like, Davis is graduating
right.
like the hallway with all the graduating classes and like the 50s and 60s, 90% men, 10% women.
At Pepperdine, I had to give a presentation about why my thing is so important. And I put up Iowa State's 72 graduating class and 2022 graduating class. The demographics are 100. It was like a flip.
Yeah.
It was a flip. It was like the 72 class was all guys in tuxedos and probably one or two women. Absolutely opposite in 2022.
Yeah.
And I don't think we've changed the profession enough to help support the feminization of the profession. I'm a girl dad. I have 3 daughters. I think women are extremely amazing. My wife is an incredible woman, an amazing veterinarian. She was able to balance the full-time work with mom. But it is hard because a lot of these women come out of traditional beliefs, right? So not only is their job veterinary medicine, then their job's at home too, right? Like setting up carpool, setting up doctor appointments, making sure homework
soccer
is
practice.
Done.
Yeah,
yeah, all those things. And so that's why I think it's very hard on female veterinarians.
But she had your support as a supportive husband, you know? So, like, I see a lot of, you know, career female veterinarians that focus on, you know, their career, and they end up, you know, in their mid to late 30s without children. And, you know, yeah, they can afford their home and everything, but are they, like, happy? Like, I don't know, you know?
Well, that's another part of my dissertation, is looking at professional identity. And that's how do your values match up to the values of the profession and what is required to be successful? And a family, starting a family is, you better have that supportive husband. You know, as I tell veterinary kids who want to go to vet school or veterinary students, it's like nobody understands what you're going through other than people that have gone through it. So do not expect your significant other, your spouse, your parents, your siblings to understand. I'm taking 25 credit hours this semester. They have no idea. Like 12 is full time, right? And you're taking 25. Now, Davis is still trimester system, so I don't know what your equivalent
load
would be.
Oh, no, wait. What did we...
We were some semester.
Oh, no, yeah, we had these blocks.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really... Davis's curriculum is much different than most other vet schools. So Davis, you learned everything about one system. So you would learn pathology, anatomy, radiology, surgery, surgical implications, et cetera, all about one system. And then move on to the next versus other schools where you have anatomy class for the whole year or whatever. We did, but it was just like when you were done with that system, that was your grade. It wasn't like a grade for a semester. Is that right? It was a while ago now.
It is right, but we still had semesters, unlike the undergrad.
They just fit those blocks into the semesters.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The undergrad UC system does
the trimesters. Yeah. UCLA had that.
They always have to be different in California.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it is. I'd like to go back to your burnout comment. How did you realize you were burning out, and how did you pull yourself out?
Yeah.
Because most of the time, people don't know they're burnout until they're just well past the, I can get out of this.
Yeah, I think what happened, it was a confluence of, things in my life that all kind of happened at the same time. My dog, like Nate Dog, who, Danny... came with me to pick up when I was in vet school at the Oakland shelter after I neutered him. He passed away, and that was, a few months ago. And around that time, I'd been working like just ER long shifts, 10, 12 hour shifts, and working a lot of days because ER work, especially on a relief basis, it pays well. So it's kind of hard to not want to pick up those shifts when they're available, and my desire to be a doctor for the client decreased. My interests have always been what's best for the patient? Let's do what's best for the patient. And I realize after this whole experience that we're treating the client in addition to treating the patient. Like the client, especially on ER, the emotions are high. Something is wrong with their pet. It's expensive. You put those factors together and it becomes emotional for the client. And so in some ways, especially in ER more than on GP, although you have to do this on GP as well, you have to be almost a therapist for the client sometimes. And I think I had gotten to a point where I was kind of neglecting that aspect of the profession and just kind of here's what's going on with your pet. This is what we need to do about it. Do you want to do it or not? Not having that, not giving the client the extra time, not giving the client, the empathy that he or she needed at the time. And I ended up having a negative client experience with one particular client that just got really complicated. And I probably won't go into the details of what happened there. But it was very stressful for me, took an emotional toll on me, affected my relationship with the hospital that I was working at the time. And again, my dog had passed away, I think, like a week or two before. So all those things kind of combined to create a situation where...
The perfect storm.
Yeah, the perfect storm. And I was like, I think I need like to take a step back and take a little bit of a break and focus on like my self-care. And I've been doing that since, and it's life is good. Like, I'm happy about it.
So basically what you did is you went from a state of deep acting where you truly cared and wanted to talk and show your empathy and really be there for the client to a state of surface acting where you had to put on, you had to fake a smile, basically.
Essentially. Well, I don't even think, here's the thing, I didn't care to do it. That was the problem.
Oh, so you were
not even the fake smile.
Yeah. Like I didn't care.
Just kind of going through the motions.
Yeah. Just going through the
Nathan's
motions.
Nathan's lucky though, because he's like always been super self-aware, and I think you were like raised that way too.
Yeah,
like knowing
for sure.
Knowing your family.
Yeah.
Like so, but not everybody has that ability and luxury to be so self-aware.
Are you there yet? Have you had a situation?
I had it during my internship. I almost quit my internship and was like, fuck this, this is not for me.
Correct.
You know, like the biggest thing for me was the hours and not having control over what I was doing as an intern. Like,
you didn't have the autonomy to do
nothing. Even in vet school, I had autonomy because, like, I don't know, frankly, vet school, like, even like fourth year, like, the caseload's not high. You see, like, two patients, depending on the service that you're on, get your records done, do rounds. So, I would, like, my house is 5 minutes from the vet hospital. I'd go home at lunch and hang out for a couple hours with my dogs and then go back at five for rounds or whatever. So, my first year out as an intern, and like especially on like the surgery services when I really burned out, I would get there at like 6:30 to assess the hospitalized patients, rounds from 8 to 9, full day of like consults. We had 3 surgeons, surgeries, transfers from ER. Some like there is a whole week where I was there from like 6:30 a.m. till 11:30 p.m. the entire week, and I was just like, I don't have a choice here. I can't say like I'm not. Okay, like, can I go home early today? Even though, like, it's not super fair because there's 3 surgeons, 1 intern on the rotation. Why does my schedule have to be whoever the earliest surgeon is and whoever the latest surgeon is? Like, I have to be there for all of it. So that took a huge toll on me. And I was like, I don't think I can put up with this. I'm just too, like, I'm too independent to be on this type of schedule. And so I reached out to a bunch of, like veterinary mentors that I had and talked it out and got like professional mental health help, which I was no stranger with before then, but hadn't needed it as a professional yet. And I finished my internship, but towards the end of internship, I really fell in love with ER, and you know, that's where I've been since. And then as like a staff ER doctor, I think that there's been, you know, some times where I've been more stressed out than others, but I haven't had like an experience like Nathan's had outside of my internship, at least, where I've been like, I need to make a major change in what I'm currently doing.
You're lucky. You're very lucky.
I've always found, I guess like the last year and a half working as a receiving only, I've started to get really bored because I'm good at my job. There's not a lot that surprises me. And so a lot of stuff has just become really routine. And I do, like, fortunately, I've never lost, like, empathy with clients. That's always been, like, one feedback thing that I've always gotten is, like, oh, your clients really like you. And, like, people are, like, surprised sometimes because outside of being in the room with the client, I'm a little bit different. Like, I'm quick, I'm blunt, I'm like sarcastic a lot, but with the clients, they think they can just tell I care a lot. So I haven't had, I've had some bad client experiences, but overall, like mostly like very good experiences, which is I think what's kept me like feeling like mentally good as a professional, just like good feedback from clients. That's the closest thing we can get to feedback from the pets themselves.
Yeah.
Aside from them like healing.
Well, the pet can go home doing absolutely great, and the client will still be pissed at you.
Yeah, you this like they had to wait an extra 30 minutes for a discharge, and you got a 1-star Yelp review, even though they came in with the GDV. And,
screw Yelp, screw Google review.
Yeah,
I would
recommend new grads stay out of the reviews for your hospital. That stuff can be. It's just like Instagram or TikTok or whatever. I don't use, and recently stopped using social media like five months ago, which has been a blessing, to be honest. I would encourage more people to do that too.
I got out of social media for about 12 years, and now this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair if it's something that you're doing that relates to your career, then you should still stay out of the comment section. Like if you have an Instagram for your podcast, like stay out of the comment section. But same thing with reviews for your hospital. Like those things are always like out of context. The negative reviews are only someone's usually misinterpreted side of the story.
Trained. How do they know?
Yeah,
they,
exactly. You know? And, you know, like every... It's not worth your time and energy because you're going to feel negatively after reading it. I can promise you that. It's not worth reading the positive ones to have to read the negative ones because you'll get the positive feedback in person and stuff as well.
Since you guys are more recent than me, do you think veterinary schools are falling short on the mental health piece?
Not UC Davis in particular. I mean, I can't speak for the other schools, but. That was a big emphasis that they put on, we had like a mental health like counselor or something like that. But having said that, if they really cared about like student mental health, they would
require mental health checks.
That would be an interesting
idea. Yeah, like required check-ins would. Make more sense. Davis had a full-time psychologist employed just for the vet department.
When did they start that? Because the suicide phenomenon, which I hate talking about.
I think a few years before we started. I think that was like relatively new, but not brand new.
Right. Yeah. I'm a member of Mentor Vet, and I had to take a question, persuade, refer course, a QPR course, because of the suicide problem, which, you know, I don't know when that became such an issue. Like we overtook Dennis, which is insane to me, right?
Yeah.
I what do you think that trigger is? Do you think it's because these students coming in already have some mental health issues, trying to be such perfectionists their whole career?
I think it's multifactorial for sure, and that's probably part of it. Like the newer grads are of a completely different generation that grew up with the internet in the palm of their hand and less direct social interaction, more digital interaction. And so that's definitely going to affect. And also some of the newer grads like were doing clinics during COVID and they didn't have person-to-person interactions. And so coming out, that's a, you know, something that they didn't get enough experience with and makes their job a bit harder. As far as like the dentist, my friend Dr. Kyle Stanley, he's a like cosmetic dental surgeon. He does talks all around the country and internationally too for the dental profession about mental health and business ownership, and you'd probably be pretty interested. He like tries to do everything very like logically and algorithmically. Here's the five things that you're doing wrong, blah blah blah. But he's a really intelligent guy, great dentist, and sheds a lot of light on a profession that has similar mental health issues that ours does, because I think that at least compared to human medicine, dentists and veterinarians are set up to have to be more of a one-stop shop than it is in human medicine. In human medicine, you might have 8 appointments before you finally see the person that's going to fix you. A lot of times when clients are bringing their pets or themselves to the dentist, they don't want to have to go anywhere else. They're like, what, you can't just fix all of this? And, you know, I think that there's a lot of factors that contribute to people being ill-prepared for practice. Some of it social, some of it like imposter syndrome, which I, similar to you, not thinking that like burnout was like, how could this be a real thing? I thought that about imposter syndrome because I was always very confident, and it's like, it's not very alpha to feel imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I felt that early on in internship too. And like, man, I haven't seen this type of case. I haven't seen this type of case. What if this comes in? What if this comes in? Blah, blah, blah.
They actually bleed when you cut them with a scalpel.
That part wasn't surprising to me, but just more of like types of conditions I hadn't directly managed yet that I'd only managed in my brain or in a textbook.
Yeah, you don't. So how important was mentorship once you graduated?
Mentorship to me has always been very, very important, even before school. My dad passed away when I was like 12, so, and he wasn't the best like father figure, so I kind of had to like seek other like people in my life for mentorship, and so it's never been difficult for me to find good mentors, and I have a lot of close friends that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're mentors, but like if you have close friends, especially if they're in the profession, then you can talk about the things that happened, you know, and speak freely and be comfortable about it. But in terms of like my mentors now, like Dr. Jim Clark has always been a mentor, UC Davis. I have like weekly conversations with a guy named Craig Marshall, who was a child Hollywood actor, and then he became a monk for 30 years, and he's an older gentleman, we talk about, you know, the daily stuff that happens in my life, but most of those conversations are like at a higher level, and that helps to kind of just put things into perspective for me. So, yeah.
I've always had really great mentorship as a DVM because I was at an internship at a specialty hospital, and I've stayed on at a specialty hospital. So I think that's afforded me an opportunity to just continue to grow in my knowledge and skill base. Like I've always said, like there's really rarely a day that I leave work that I haven't learned something new. And I think it's a waste of a day if I haven't learned something new that day. And that's something that has kept me away from doing GP or doing like relief work, is being part of that team has been really important to me. And then before that school, I had some like important veterinary mentors as well, like one GP doctor that was willing to let me start as a volunteer assistant at his hospital. And then when I was a assistant at a specialty hospital, the cardiology resident there, Dr. Morgan Stern, who's now head of cardiology at this specialty hospital in Long Island, like was always like patient and took the time to like answer all of the questions that I had about cardiology, and was like, you know, willing, yeah, just interested in helping someone learn. I think mentorship's super important. I think it's probably really difficult to find as a new doctor that's going to like a busy GP practice and just hitting the ground running,
because not all the doctors there want a mentor.
Yeah, and who has the time to do it? It may be the owner of the hospital if they're that person and they're not seeing as many appointments during the week or whatever. But all the other doctors, like, I mean, it's hectic, you know, seeing appointments every 30 minutes, doing procedures, all of that. Like, who has time to sit down and talk through a case? You know,
exactly.
It's mostly just like they'll answer like quick questions for you and whatnot. But it's a lot different than like doing an internship and like having to kind of be the backup for, you know, and watch the internist do their conversation with the client or find out what questions you forgot to ask when you were getting the history. And yeah, like take the passenger seat for a year. I think internship's super important. And I, like, if I felt like a bit of an imposter during my internship, I can't imagine how I would have felt if I had gone straight into practice somewhere. I've respected you for just kind of like, well, I'm going to start moonlighting at this ER. You know, that's pretty ballsy.
Well, that's pretty ballsy to do that. But I had great mentors. If you have great mentors, I think
that's great. You could have a smooth transition for sure, but you need that. If you're just getting thrown in, like, I mean, unfortunately, working in ER and critical care, we get a lot of cases transferred over. We're looking at the notes and it's like, what the heck were you thinking here?
Yeah,
and
you got to be so careful.
Yeah, that's something that's been hard for me to learn the last, you know, since I've been out, and you don't know the full story all the time. And so it's important to try not to judge, but I think that people do kind of get thrown in the fire and maybe aren't ready for some of the things that they're seeing. And also, like I said earlier, like, oh, these people are relying on me, this patient's relying on me, I need to figure this out. And there's always an option for a transfer or whatever else, like, there, but you can feel like the weight of the world's on your shoulders at the time, and you need to figure everything out, or the client doesn't want to transfer and they want you to figure it out. It can be a difficult situation to be in, but I think that, you know, ultimately mentorship can help. Nothing's going to prepare you for every single situation you find yourself in, but I think really good mentorship or an internship that's in a good setting. There's toxic internships out there too that you don't want nothing to do with, because it might make you leave the field. But if you can find good mentorship, whether starting your GP career or through an internship, I think it'll put you light years ahead of where you would be if you were simply just stuck on your own.
But there's also some internship nightmares too.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, there's some internships where it might make you want to quit the profession.
Yeah, I mean, one of my guests, while she was doing an internship, all the other interns quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard stories like that. Like, one of my roommates from vet school, I won't say where he did his internship, but it was a lot different than mine. Like, he pretty much worked 7 days a week, even on his days off. If the service that he was on had hospitalized patients, he had to go in and do soaps in a set. Like that's not a day off, and I don't think that's even legal. And they've since changed that, because my I don't know if it was directly related to him or not, but he let somebody higher up know that that's what they were having to do. But you take a look at, like, the medical field. My dad was originally a human internal medicine resident, and then switched to emergency because that became a specialty at that time, and like this whenever that was, the 70s. And he worked like 48 hours straight sometimes. That used to be what was expected of you. And I think that did make it more of like a gauntlet to get through. And those that succeeded were stronger because of it. But that doesn't make it right to put people through that. And I think that the incidence of mistakes has been shown to go up quite a bit when people are working odd hours and prolonged hours.
So last question, what skill beyond medicine would you, if a veterinary student came to you and said, I need to learn a skill beyond medicine, what would you recommend it be?
I would say, as kind of Danny alluded to, like, understanding what, like, being aware of how, you know, of how your work is affecting you, and learning how to, find a balance in your personal life that allows you to be content in your profession. So, self-care, I guess, you know, that's a skill that everybody needs to learn. Because if you don't have it, a lot of people do just focus on their work, and that's all they know, and that's all they think about, and that's all they do, and that's a recipe for burnout. It's a total recipe for burnout. So, learn how to take care of yourself. Learn how to take care of yourself, because no one's gonna do that for you, and no one's gonna like, especially in the corporate world, how it is. Like, if you're a doctor and you allow yourself to get taken advantage of, you will get taken advantage of if you don't protect yourself. So learning how to protect yourself, protect your time, respect yourself and respect your time are, and that's another one of the things that Dr. Clark,
yeah, jealous guardian of your time.
Jealous guardian of your time, you know, and that certainly stuck with me. I don't know if it did.
Learn how to say no.
Yeah.
You know, your hours aren't infinite in your day, and work's not everything in life. I think that there's some people, i.e. Dr. Stan Marks, UC Davis, triple boarded, sleeps like 3 hours a night. He's happy doing that. It's not the majority of us. And if you're like most of the rest of us, my advice would be find joy in things outside of veterinary medicine. It's easy to say like, oh, work-life balance. What does that mean? Doesn't mean just mean having time off from work. It means doing valuable things for yourself during that time. Things that are healthy for you, both physically and mentally. I think hobbies are really important.
Go fishing, go hiking, take up painting,
I think being creative is really important. I think that medicine's more of a creative field than most people think. It's not all black and white stuff, especially veterinary medicine, where you don't just get to do whatever the heck you want to and you have to work within budgets. You'd be a little more creative. But creative hobbies to me are really important. I like gardening and landscaping. I do woodworking. I make music. I play instruments. I think those types of creative endeavors are one of the ways, and physical exertion as well, puts your mind in a different space where you will not be thinking about the bad thing that happened at work or things that stress you out. Like, cortisol levels are real, and if you spend your time off thinking about work and reading reviews and other stuff like that, you're not going to have good days off. You're going to be stressed out when you go back into work. You want to be refreshed when you go back into your week and feel like you're starting brand new. I think no matter what, by the end of your work week, you're going to be a little tired and stuff, but I think that it's really important to find things outside of veterinary medicine that really stimulate your brain and take your mind off of veterinary medicine.
Yeah, I think what Danny said, a very succinct way of saying it is manage your cortisol. Learn how to manage your cortisol and lower it. Learn how to lower your cortisol.
Well, veterinary medicine is tough, but hopefully those listening, they are as well. I mean, it's a grind. You got to take care of yourself, and this profession is going to be very rewarding. It will be. This is an amazing profession.
Yeah. I think that it takes some time to recognize the rewards sometimes. Like, so one thing I see at my hospital, because we are a specialty hospital, we have an intern program, and so I see new grads doing their internship and see what it's like, so what I probably looked like 6 years ago. And I also see new ER doctors getting hired that are just kind of figuring things out for themselves. And one thing I've recognized with some of the newer ER doctors, and that I now recognize that I definitely went through, you spend a lot of time wanting to be right and wanting the clients to approve everything you recommend and getting upset when things don't go your way. It's really hard to enjoy some of the wins. And it's really important to recognize those things at work. I've started like asking my girlfriend, like, what was your favorite case this week? You know, why was it your favorite case? You just thought the dog was cute, or you like, you know, the case was medically interesting, or you really liked the owners, or it was a combination of everything. But I think that's kind of an important thing to consider daily or at the end of your week. Like,
or journal it.
Yeah. I'm not much of a journaler, but if that's your, I do a lot of mental journaling, but if that's your thing and physically writing it down happens, then, or helps, then yeah, definitely journal it. And that might be something that just is rewarding later on to go back and look through when, you know, imagine that 10 years down the line where you've journaled your favorite case every week for 10 years. Like, oh man, I remember that. That could be kind of neat.
Yeah, you could write a book.
Yeah.
You could write a book. Hopefully that could help veterinarians. See, at my age, I do have to write it down or I totally forget. So.
Yeah.
So
I logged all of my cases last year, but that was more to like track how much money I was making for the hospital for salary negotiation purposes. But yeah, it was useful too, because
well, we could get into the whole business management piece if you'd like. But anyways, guys, it's been a pleasure. I want to have you guys back for sure. because we could keep going on forever.
Yeah, I mean,
I could talk for hours.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. Yeah.
I mean, all we got to do is just sit down and just get it going. I mean, these crucial conversations are important for people to hear.
Right? Yeah, and I don't think we, even like when we started vet school, like podcasts were like just starting and they weren't as popular. But there's such a wealth of information out there, and different ways to be exposed to information. And yeah, the more you hear from different perspectives, the better prepared you can be. And if you're thinking about becoming a veterinarian, deciding if it's something that's right for you or not, if you're currently in the midst of vet school, then, you know, learning some tools to help you get through and manage your career when you start. And if you're just starting, then, you know, seeing what different people's experiences have been and knowing that your other people have also experienced what you're experiencing and have gotten through it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah,
thank you all for listening.
Yeah.
And we'll catch you next time.